David Gardner just woke up to a nightmare in his own backyard. But no one will listen.
We landed right back there, right behind the hill.
No one will believe.
I told you, he needs psychiatric help.
And soon, no one will be left.
Dad? Are you okay, Dad?
Fine.
Because something strange is happening to the people of Willow Creek.
Everything's fine now.
And David Gardner is about to find out why.
David! I'm gonna find my mom and dad!
I'm back here! No! David Gardner?
Canon Films presents Tobe Hooper's Invaders from Mars. There's no place on Earth to hide.
Hey everyone, this is Justin from the Far Side, and that was the trailer for Invaders from Mars. If you head over to our website, farsightedblog.com, you can check out a group review in honor of Tobe Hooper of that canon classic. Batshit crazy, lots of fun, and we all miss Tobe Hooper. So thanks for checking out this, our latest addition to the podcast network, and thanks for checking out the website. Enjoy Misspent Matinee with my Grindhouse Messiah co-host, Blaine McLaren, and his ex-wife's current husband, Chris Sargent. Take it away, boys.
Welcome, guys and gals, to episode 2 of Misspent Matinee, and we're excited to be back. I'm your co-host, Blaine. I'm here with my other co-host, Chris. Hey, Chris, how's it been?
Hey, Blaine, it's going really well. I'm glad that it's the weekend. I had a just at work, a week from hell. I feel like I am finally coming back from being submerged underwater. I'm very happy to talk about Jaws and our favorite five nature run amok movies, Jaws and Paws, and I'm ready to go. How are you doing?
Oh man, I'm doing well. I've had a question all week. How do you feel about the Nazis stealing your fashion sense here recently?
yeah, you're probably talking about the Sperry's and the polo shirt. I just really hope that the Sperry's don't become a sign of white supremacy, because I'm gonna have to find another shoe to wear. Yeah, I noticed that too. They were all wearing khakis and polo shirts and Sperry's, which is an interesting look for Nazis.
Oh, absolutely. And also we have our esteemed producer, Dr. Robin. Robin, how's it been? And how's Chris' next progeny coming along?
Well, I'll speak for Robin, because she had to take our youngest, Soren, out to play in the backyard. So he really wanted to be a part of this show. So he's being quarantined right now by producer Robin.
Well, that is the best work a producer could do. The other child here, Mac, he is quietly playing video games. So we'll see how quiet that stays. But yeah, I know. Well, getting us kind of back on track here. I know it's been insane over the past few weeks. We've had Nazis in Virginia, as we spoke about, the loss of Jerry Lewis. But, hey, we're all here to help you forget about all this shit, at least for an hour or so. This week, as Chris mentioned, we'll be talking about his favorite film of all time, Jaws. We know it's the end of summer, but it's still hot, and we don't care. After discussing Jaws, we'll be hopping right into our weekly top five and weighing in on the often overlooked subgenre of nature run amok films, which, as Chris called it, our Jaws with Paws segment. Before that, Chris, what have you been watching this week?
Well, I wish I had something interesting to report. I have not been able to watch a damn thing. I really have only watched Game of Thrones and maybe a half episode of MasterChef with the boys, and that's it. Not Game of Thrones with the boys, obviously, but MasterChef with the boys, and that's it. I have been completely swamped. And so, it's been one of those dark weeks where I have had no media whatsoever. It's been really disappointing.
No, that sounds miserable. Well, I've made it up for probably for the both of us as over the past week. Got a handful of movies kind of knocked off my to-do list outside of what we watched this week. checked out a new French found footage film called Cold Ground that was disappointing in the least. Also, the newest film from Alejandro Jodorowsky, Endless Poetry, which I guess will begin a U.S. release here over the next few weeks. So check that out. There should be a review up on thefarsideofblog.com here pretty soon. Same as well with Death Note. I know it's been getting a lot of attention. Have you heard any of the backlash from Adam Wingard's Death Note?
No, I haven't. What's going on?
Apparently, which I don't know anything about anime. I have a hard time with this stuff. But apparently, they adapted the film to a, I guess, like an American feature film version, and apparently it's being whitewashed or something along those lines. I didn't see that. I know nothing about the anime. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun, like, 100-minute movie. I'm sure I'm just ignorant of what I'm supposed to know on that, but it was pretty fun. But I just named a couple more. I checked out a strange movie that I had never seen before called Malatestus Carnival of Blood. It was a bizarre kind of...
That sounds right. Up your alley.
Yeah, it's a super low-budget movie. I saw it's either from... it's either from the late 70s or the early 70s. I saw a bunch of different conflicting release dates, but it is basically this strange kind of ghoul slash vampire-ish movie that takes place. And basically it's like this carnival, but if you go below it, there's like caverns full of cannibals who sit around all day watching silent films. And it's completely bizarre and entirely watchable, a lot of fun. But it's what I liked most about it is the sets. You've got this fantastic carnival going on throughout where, you know, they're using the real set there. Then once you get below, it's like this construction of trash where everything there is like looks kind of like stuff you'd find just in your local, you know, bin. And they constructed something pretty cool. I mean, and I never came across this. I had Arrow Releases American Horror Project sitting around and just hadn't dove into it yet. And check that out. So if you do have either that release or Amazon Prime, it's available on both, and I highly suggest it. And then also got a chance to check out Sam Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, as well as David Lynch's Wild at Heart, which we're going to be covering on our other show on the Farsighted Network, Grindhouse Messiah. So stay tuned for that. Okay, so after getting a chance to talk about that, we're going to move right into our feature film of this week, which is Jaws. And Chris, this is your favorite film of all time. Why don't you take us away?
Yeah, sure. So as I said last week, Jaws really is, it's just the near and dear to my heart. I feel like I was raised on this movie. I saw it at a very early age, was immediately transfixed by the shark. The story itself is just so easy to get immersed in from the very first scene all the way through. Even at an early age, I knew that I was watching something that was special. And so I'm really happy that we get an opportunity to kind of do a deep dive on this movie and talk about what makes it so great and what makes it so special to me and to us. And to just jump right in, you know, I think the way that we're going to talk about this is just kind of go like through the movie as much as possible and just kind of talk about what jumps out at us, interesting things, that we may know either from the movie itself or from just reading about it or learning about it afterwards. So the first question that I have and the first thing that I want to talk about, which is probably the most important thing of this movie, is what in the world did that the guy say at the very beginning when they're all around the campfire and, you know, you got a whole bunch of young people sitting around the campfire on the beach and the guy just comes over and he doesn't know this girl. 3 seconds of we don't hear him speak. We have no idea what he says. 3 seconds later, she's running and taking her clothes off. So I really want to know, what is it that he said that got this random girl to just start running and taking her clothes off? I mean, it must be the best pickup line ever.
Either that or it was a deeply embedded MK Ultra experiment that he just had the magical phrase to set her off. So, yeah, no, I've always wondered that too, because he just leans over, boom, running straight naked to the to right. the ocean.
And at first you think, well, maybe he just said, let's go swimming. But then the next scene, while they're running, he's like, where are we going? And she's the one that says swimming. Right. So we have no idea what he said or why and what he was expecting when she took off running. But again, he must have just amazing game. And also, it probably just is a reflection of Steven Spielberg's idea of the mating rituals of young New Englanders and what that means for him. But that was, upon rewatching it just recently, that again just stuck out for me how unusual that is as an opening to get them into the situation where they're in the water. And then of course the classic scene, the hook of the whole movie where the girl goes out into the water, the guy passes out in the sand, with the surf coming up on him. So you have to be really drunk to do that. And the girl just, you know, out by the buoy and the bell, she gets attacked by Jaws. And you get that wonderful shot from underneath where she's swimming on the surface of the water. And then you hear that music. And then you're hooked for the rest of the movie. I mean, it really is a hook. You're in for the rest of the movie because it's so frightening. And back then, it's something that people really had never seen before.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think it really is one of those just iconic scenes where you see really a shift in how movies are made. That cold opening, getting us to Jaws, is just one of the greats of all time. I put that on the same level as the shower scene in Psycho, and that same kind of level of iconography. Even if you've never seen Jaws, you know that scene. It's kind of part of the entire universal consciousness, where you know that dun dun and just the bobbing, Chrissy bobbing out there as Jaws takes hold of her. So yeah, no, it's one of those scenes in the movie that it never gets old to me, and I can revisit that 100 times a year.
Yeah, and then, you know, we're right into the movie. We're introduced to Roy Scheider's character, Chief Brody, one of the great characters of cinema, I think. He's absolutely perfect for this part. And in doing my research, I discovered that some other actors had been considered for this part, one of which was Charlton Heston, who would have been completely different. It would have been a completely different movie with Moses in the part of Chief Brody. And then the consigliere from Godfather, Robert Duvall, was also considered for that part. And while he might be closer to the nice guy sensitivity that Roy Scheider brings and just the good-natured desire to do what's best and that kind of thing, it still feels like Roy Scheider's, just his likability, his vulnerability, just as an actor, the thing that is just that you get from just almost on a subliminal level when you watch him, it just makes the movie, it grounds it in a reality. He's not really a hero. He is heroic when he needs to be, but he doesn't want to be. Just that introduction of him with his family, the sunlight coming through the windows, and then of course just the mizen scene that just takes off from there, grounding you in this town, in this New England culture. It's just wonderful.
Oh, absolutely, and that's one thing I was going through that, and I saw that the other people that were considered for it. This would have been in a completely different movie if Charlton Heston would have been hamming it up in that role. But Roy Scheider is so good at it. He's so like everyman to where you don't get – he's one of those actors. I always describe him as kind of just blending into the scenery in the best way, where it's not distracting. It doesn't feel like he's acting, in the quotations. He seems so natural. He seems like a dude. Where I think, Charlton Heston, he would have turned it up to 11 and it would have been fun, but it would have been really grandiose and probably laughable. And also Robert Duvall, which who knows, that could have been good, but at that point he was so young. I think Schneider just bringing that, you know, that face of his, and at that age he's in. I mean, it just feels, he feels like a guy who's old enough to know what he's doing, but average enough to be relatable.
Yeah, and I like the one of the things that struck me on reviewing, in terms of cinematography and lighting, is the use of this kind of washed out sunshine, and it just has such an unusual, unique feel that really does kind of place you in. I mean, I can see being on a New England shore and having that exact lighting, meeting those exact people, and so all praise to Spielberg. A lot of his choices in this movie are it's a masterclass. It really is. And his choices in actors in particular, I think the four actors that really stick out, the mayor,
Murray Hamilton. Yes.
Murray Hamilton, my favorite. Famous from The Graduate. I guess the Hustler, right? And a couple other films. But he is absolutely perfect as the mayor.
Oh, yeah. And those suits are fucking on point. I love when he shows up with the anchor suit.
I want one of those. That thing's boss. Yeah. And he's not a bad guy. It's just that his priorities are mismatched to the threat that they're facing. His priorities are what you would expect from a mayor. You want the town to pull in revenue. You want the beaches to be open. But he comes across as such a kind of a slime ball, and he's perfect for the part. And of course the Matt Hooper they ran through a couple other actors. I think Kevin Kline was up for the part. And ultimately, it went to now I'm forgetting his name.
Richard Dreyfuss.
Richard Dreyfuss, that's right. And so Richard Dreyfuss, I think, originally turned down the part. He didn't feel like it was going to be a pleasant experience. I think he read that it was actually going to be filmed on the Atlantic Ocean, and he initially checked out. He said that he would love to watch the movie. He would hate to film it. But I really can't imagine anyone else being Matt Hooper in that part either. But of course, the one that really stands out to me is Robert Shaw as Quint. And I really cannot imagine this movie with anyone else as Quint. I don't know if there was ever an actor on earth that could have played this part like Robert Shaw did.
Oh, yeah. He is iconic. In my mind, I always, you always remember all, the John Williams score, the poster, the opening scene with the shark attack. But when you watch that movie, the real standout is Quint. Every single time he's on screen, he demands your attention, and it goes down as one of my favorite performances of all time. And I forget that it's Robert Shaw, because he is just complete. He's Quint 100% in that movie. He's grizzled.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the way his cadence is, it's amazing. Like, yeah, it's one of the great performances.
He completely inhabits the character of this salty New England fisherman. It's kind of a town outsider. Has some demons that really drive him to act quite unreasonably later on. But just his presence. The way that he speaks and his personality on screen is so charismatic, but also so brash and caustic. It really is. It's one of the best performances in cinematic history. I'm going to go down and say that it really is. And unfortunately, he passed away about 4 or 5 years after the film came out, and had a couple of, and I think during the filming, I think he was under he was dealing with some alcoholism and tax problems and everything. It was not a very pleasant part of his life. I did hear that he and Richard Dreyfuss just did not get along.
Oh, really? I've never heard that story.
That the tension between them was real. once they're on the boat and they're back and forth like that, after the camera stopped filming, it continued offset. It was a real thing.
See, I've never heard that part of the story, but it makes sense because he is just riding him from every moment that they're on the boat. It's just one thing after another, you know. He just gives, you know, Hooper do this, Hooper do that. What are you doing up there? That is awesome little bit of trivia there.
Yeah, and I also want to give a shout out to Lorraine Gary, who plays Ellen Brody, Mrs. Brody. The reason why I really like her in this role is that I believe every bit of her relationship with Chief Brody. I believe that, you know, the way that they interact with each other, their chemistry, the small grace notes to her performance, that how naturalistic it is. Actually, Spielberg chose her because of how naturalistic she is as an actor. It really kind of grounds the whole thing in this sense of reality that if this is a family man, this is a decent man who's in a good relationship and who's forced into a situation that he doesn't want and forced to do things to solve a problem that becomes very personal.
Go ahead. Oh, you know, I was just going to say, and I always think she kind of gives a little bit of a voice of reason when we're finally making it to, you know, that they're going out to get Jaws. She's giving him this vibe kind of like, why are you going out there? Like, I've always kind of got that from her performance where it seems like kind of like she realizes that he's not only feels like he has a responsibility to protect the town, but he's also kind of jazzed about going on an adventure with these, like, what I think Brody views as kind of men's men, you know, with Quint and everything like that. You can tell she's being supportive, but she's not really seeing the logic of why a guy who's never been on a boat is going to chase down a killer shark.
That's right. So she gives him that line where he's like, why don't you go home? And she says, home New York? And he's like, no, home here.
Right.
Right. She's completely over this entire situation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things I brought up last week was what I appreciate about this film is that the structure is not necessarily and really is like most films, as most people know who are listening to this, are three acts. They're divided into three acts. And there's this kind of way of going about transitioning from one act to the other. This film really is a two act film. It's the first act is set on land. It's basically a serial killer movie played as a small town procedural. And so you have all of these small town procedural notes that they hit. You know, you have the body that they discover from unknown causes, a mystery killer. They had a coroner scene where they put together some clues about what the killer is or is like. You have the late night investigation. You have that, you know, the mayor is the what in a procedural movie would be the police or the boss, always getting into conflict with our hero, always stymieing his what is actually reasonable requests and recommendations for how they should go about doing things. And then after that great set piece on the beach on 4th of July, when you start out with the fake out with the kids, the mass stampede, and then the actual attack in the lake that involves Chief Brody's son, then it becomes a personal quest. And Moby Dick, and I mentioned Moby Dick last week, and that is actually, it was going to be more on the nose. Spielberg was going to actually have Robert Shaw's character introduced in a movie theater while watching Moby Dick. So this is not just something that I discovered, but the Moby Dick theme of this kind of obsession turned into madness and this personal quest to overcome personal demons is throughout that second part. And it's just the way that movie transitions from one to the other is so it has, in my experience as a movie watcher, I don't know of any other comparison to it.
Oh yeah, because there is very few movies that kind of follow this structure and do it so well. Because, yeah, it really does make sense because, you know, you have, like, kind of the stalk and prey kind of scenes. You get this kind of lighthearted back and forth. And then all of a sudden, the movie takes this kind of dark turn as we enter into, like, the last third of the runtime. And, yeah, with Quint, that makes more sense mentioning the Moby Dick angle because this is one thing we'll talk about maybe a little bit later, but a few of the things that I do have not any kind of major beef, but a little bit of a problem with is how quickly it goes dark with Quint. And you get later, but playing off this, you know, this Ahab idea, it makes a lot more sense. So no, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And you know, he really has a classic death wish, where, you know, it's like the Freudian death wish where he starts behaving irrationally because of this obsession. And we'll get to this too, but that scene where he reveals why he has become this basically shark hunter, this guy who's obsessed with killing and displaying dead sharks. And it really, you know, so the way that his character kind of is revealed, you know, I actually think it makes sense that his, you know, the acts that he does in the movie that are kind of dark and sudden and seemingly villainous, like breaking the radio or burning out the engine while they're being chased by a giant shark because he just doesn't want to listen to reason. But, you know, all of those things actually do make sense when you think about the trauma that he experienced as a sailor on the Indianapolis. Sitting in the water, watching his friends die. So I think he said 6 an hour for days, waiting to be rescued, and what that would do to somebody.
Oh yeah, no, I mean it gives you an idea of why he's there because he kind of comes in like a phantom in the film where he just shows up and he's ready to kill a shark. Once you get that, then everything else kind of starts falling in line with what his ultimate goal is here and the motivation, because everybody in this film has a motivation and it's so fantastic when that finally is finally revealed and he gives that amazing monologue, you know.
All right, so no, I'm really glad you brought up that point, Blaine, about how all the characters feel lived in and that they're acting according to their own internal logic that has been developed over the course of the narrative. And each character is so precisely placed on like this spectrum of personality that you really do believe this kind of conflict that develops between Hooper and Quint. You believe the friendship that develops between Hooper and Chief Brody. Everything really does feel, and then even with the shark is not just used as a scare or as an action point, but as a further development of these men who have been placed in this crucible where the core personality traits come to the fore. And so I do think that it kind of separates itself from other movies in this genre where the characters are fully formed, they go in, they act to type, and then the movie ends. And in the middle, you know, they get into a hijinks with the monster. But in this one, it really does feel like the shark is almost this spiritual terror that pulls the core traits out of these men. And so that what we're left with is exactly who they are at the very core of their personality.
And that is incredibly true. I mean, especially once we get, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but once we get towards the end of the film and the ultimate, face off, you see who rises to the occasion and whose intentions were correct the whole time, because there is still like in most of Spielberg's work, this air of righteousness and you kind of get where everyone's coming from and those intentions. Once everything has kind of been already stripped away, these guys are kind of at their most core versions of themselves. I love how they end up wrapping it up and how they do it.
Yeah, I do too. And then of course, a lot of things had to happen to make this movie what it is. And I don't want to forget to talk about the score and the theme, the famous Jaws theme, the da-da, da-da. That theme is, and I was reading about this when I was researching the film for our podcast, and when John Williams first presented that theme to Steven Spielberg, Steven Spielberg laughed because he thought he was joking, because it was just so simple and primal, and he was like, okay, what really? Where's the actual Jaws theme? And I can't. I mean, who can you even imagine any other theme to go with Jaws? It is absolutely perfect. It's so perfect that it even works on Soren, our, you know, 3-year-old. He hears that music, he jumps up and says shark.
Right. No, it is synonymous with the idea of sharks. Now, it's got to be odd for people like us where, you know, this film came out in 1977. We've only known, you know, since we were, you know, incredibly small, that sound means shark. And outside of, you know, all the great scores John Williams has done, I think between this and of course the Darth Vader the tune
Imperial March,
yeah, the Imperial March and the Jaws score, I don't think that there's any other score that's more synonymous than those two.
And really, no composer that is synonymous with cinema like he is. I think he's at the pinnacle. He's definitely on the Mount Rushmore of composers for cinema. Everything that he did in that time, for over a 30, 40 year time frame, is everything that he made is irretrievably attached to the movie and the feeling of the movie that it's in. So you obviously have Star Wars, and the big ones are Star Wars and Jaws and Indiana Jones. And, I'm sure I'm forgetting a whole bunch that are as iconic, but he is that theme. It's so funny to watch Soren because he gets nervous. Like, as soon as that theme starts, he starts curling up into a ball, like tense, ready for action. He starts talking about how the shark is about to eat somebody. It's something else to watch. And then, of course, another thing that was upon rewatching it very recently, that I noticed was having a deep effect on me was this not the underwater camera, but the camera that's right on the surface. It's kind of floating on the surface where it's dipping underneath the waves and then coming back up. And that feel, it's completely immersive. That feel that you are in the water, this is happening to you. You know, whether or not it's on the boat with the boat rocking in the last act, or whether it's being right next to the old man who's getting trampled during the stampede, and during the 4th of July beach scene, that kind of camera work, the cinematography, it just really, you notice these things after having learned a little bit about movies and how they can subtly or subliminally manipulate an audience into a feeling, and it really does. I can't imagine having done it in any other way, and including the handheld stuff on the boat. It really is. And I say masterclass a lot, but this movie is a masterclass. You can teach an entire film course on this movie and on the decisions that Spielberg has made.
Oh yeah, and with those kind of first person views and everything, where they really put, you put the viewer in those spots. That's one thing that I've always kind of missed about the early work of Steven Spielberg, the stuff that kind of got lost along the way. Because with movies like this, as well as Duel, and some of those early films, am I wrong? He didn't do Duel, did he?
No, he did Duel. That was a TV movie that he created. And it was one of his very first, with the trucks. You're talking about the one with the trucks, right?
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, kind of the intensity that comes from movies like Duel and Jaws in the beginning, where he was so good at building that tension and putting you in those spots. As he kind of went along, it's hard to think that intensity carries over to the same guy who ended up making Hook, which is a very different film altogether.
And I completely agree. You know, I think that while he's had some really good movies lately, you know, I really enjoy Minority Report. I'm probably one of the few that is, that really enjoys War of the Worlds. And I think Munich is a great piece of filmmaking, even though I don't really want to go back and watch it. But really, back in his heyday, when he was making films like E.T. and Indiana Jones and Jaws, it seemed like he had more of a deft touch on tone, on characters, on scene setting and transitions, that kind of thing. Or maybe that's just because those movies are a part of us, are in our marrow, in a way that maybe movies that we saw when we were adults are not. But, you know, I think his choices in this movie, in terms of, you know, and one of the other things that struck me was that he has the classic, anytime Spielberg films at night, he has fog and he has light beams cutting through the fog to give this kind of spooky ambient lighting. You know, from, you know, I think people will recall the very first scene in E.T. where the trucks show up, the man with the keys steps out. You have the for no reason whatsoever, you have billowing clouds of fog coming up off the trees, and they're running through, and you have the spaceship lights hitting the fog. That's his go-to, and it really is effective. It creates a scene, and the scene that I'm thinking of right now is when they go out on the boat, and they're after they cut the shark open, they find Ben Gardner's boat, and you see Hooper's boat slowly come into the frame. It's kind of surrounded by the beams of light coming off the ship, and it just comes across as very tense and anxiety inducing and beautiful. Those kind of things, while you don't notice them when you're young, really do have a big effect on you.
Oh, absolutely. And I got to ask, did that scene in E.T. scare the shit out of you when you were a kid? Because it scared me for some reason.
I actually had nightmares about that for years. I saw it when I was probably 4 or 5. I had nightmares about that first scene with E.T. screaming and running through the underbrush, the foliage, and in my dreams, he was a goblin, and it scared the shit out of me. And even thinking about those dreams, like, I have some kind of like residual fear. He affects when he's at his best. Spielberg really affects people on a very deep level. That is, you know, it's subliminal, it's emotional, it's transportive, and it marks him as one of the best directors and movie makers of our time.
No, absolutely. And yeah, because you go through those early films, even his segment in the Twilight Zone movie, he always nails that eeriness. And I love him for it. And yeah, and with what you were saying before, I want to kind of revisit this. When we talk about these earlier films of Spielberg, I know that a lot of it's embedded in just the nostalgia, because there's kind of we're kind of that Amblin generation, you know, those of us born between like 78 and 85, where this is how we grew up thinking about, you know, blockbuster movies and family film. It was kind of this dark, fantastical, you know, kind of scary, kind of funny blend of you know, those movies coming out of Amblin, you know, which, you know, also included and extended to films like Gremlins and Poltergeist, where I do think there's a lot of, you know, horror fans that come out of this generation, because that was stuff that was considered family film when we were a kid, you know, which would now be hard pressed, you know, probably close, you know, a hard PG-13 or close to an R if you left them as is. So I think I always loved the way that Spielberg handled that, especially in those earlier years, where it was something that was made for young people, but still scary enough and not afraid to also make you piss your pants.
Yeah, and I think you can't be a movie lover without loving Spielberg and his and at least a good handful of his movies and appreciating them for what they are. You know, now we have his torchbearers with Stranger Things, You know, J.J. Abrams famously named his production company Bad Hat Harry after a line in Jaws where Roy Scheider's Chief Brody turns to this old guy after, you know, he's like, oh, you don't like to go in the water, do you? He's like, that's some bad hat, Harry. You know, he's had such an effect on the next generation of filmmakers because of his, you know, it's not just that he does action or not just that he does any particular genre. It's that he imbues it with like this forebodingness, this haunting naturalism. And that, and at the same time that there's humor and there's little grace notes of characterization and lightness. And you walk away from one of those early Spielberg movies, you really do feel like you went through an event, an experience itself that is going to stay with you.
Oh yeah. And one thing that I like about revisiting his films every couple of years is as I get older, I kind of respond to things a lot differently throughout the movie, because when I was watching the film, for some reason, the scene that I guess I walked away with a new love for was after, you know, it's all said and done, and maybe it's because I'm a parent, but after, you know, his son is in shock, but he's okay. He sees the mayor coming through. He grabs him, he pulls him aside, reaches in his pocket, takes a cigarette out of
his pen,
and you know, and starts just going, hey, this is what we got to do, you know, and breaks down the plan, and he kind of finally takes hold of the situation. And for some reason, that was like the scene that I walked away with, like this whole new love, like, man, like the way that was put together and how, you know, it feels really extended, not a lot of cuts. It just, it feels so real, and you could relate, and you're rooting for, you know, Chief Brody to finally kind of, you know, just grab the mayor and shake him. And he does it in such, you know, such a classy way.
And I'm glad you said that about the way that it's the way that it's shot, the way that it's really there are two scenes like right, kind of clustered together or closely together that are just one takes where there's so the first scene is when Hooper and Chief Brody are arguing with the mayor in front of the big billboard sign that has been vandalized with the shark. That is all one take. And The amount of control over the cinematography, the choreography, getting the actors to hit their marks, the change in angles, you watch that and you don't realize what it's doing to you. But what it's doing to you is that you're just completely there. And then, of course, the hospital scene that you're referring to is all one take. They start getting into a conversation around the assistant's desk or the nurse's desk, and then they start walking back, the camera goes with them, they close the curtain, and they have that scene where he grabs the pen, he makes him sign, we're gonna hire Quint, we're gonna get this thing done. And then and you realize, of course, this is the way Chief Brody is acting, because it just became very personal.
Oh yeah. And it's like that scene in every, like you mentioned, the serial killer side, it's kind of that scene where it finally like hits home and it, like, almost takes out someone close to him. It's like you've been waiting the whole time, and he rises to the occasion, and we know that we're finally kicking off this other part of the movie where now the humans are going to try to take at least some modicum of control, and oh, he nails it.
And not a dare, but as a suggestion to our listeners, if you want to see a movie that has pretty much the same structure as Jaws and is a dealing with this kind of serial killer type of issue, this mysterious, unknowable killer that's coming in from the edges and taking out people, Zodiac. The story beats in Zodiac, and I did this once, match up almost precisely in terms of like even minutes. You know, so they, and 15 minutes in to Jaws, we have the attack on the little boy. 15 minutes into Zodiac, we have the attack on the couple at the lake. You know, it really is that kind of manipulation of the audience just through like the melody of the story itself it time and time again, you can revisit it and get something new out of it. I do want to have a special shout out to Peter Benchley as the reporter on the beach with his butterfly collar. I mean, he really does look like a like Clark Kent's alcoholic younger brother. It's amazing. I heard that Peter Benchley was just absolutely terrible on set. You know, he ended up, I think, just washing his hands of it because no one wanted to take his suggestions. He wanted his book basically recreated, like scene by scene. But every time I see him in that role, he's just so out of place.
Oh yeah, no, he is a fun. That's a fun thing to see. When you have the context outside the context, I've always wondered before I knew that, I was like, who is this guy? Why is he in the movie? Because it's so throwaway, but it's there. But yeah, no, it's great and watching it now knowing that that's who it is and not just a really bizarre casting choice.
That's right. That's right. Because it would have been a really bizarre casting choice. And then just to go back to some praise about the cinematography and the directorial decisions, at that scene on the beach during the 4th of July, after they had the big fake out, and then the call, the shark call, starts reverberating from a different area. No one really believes it. No one's reacting to it now. They think it's just another hoax. And the camera stays on Chief Brody as he starts to move through the crowd faster and then faster, and he starts running. And as he's moving faster, this camera stays on his face. The concern on his face starts to increase, like at a pretty much direct correlation with his speed. And it's just, it just brings that emotion into you. It makes you feel like, oh, well, that's just another thing. Oh, wait a minute. This is no. And then he starts running and then it becomes personal. And then for the rest of the movie, it's a personal quest. This is a quest for revenge. This is a shark that has terrorized his family, and he is out there and he is going to get his revenge. He's going to kill this shark.
No, I agree. And I know there's one big thing that we haven't talked about yet, and that is Quint's monologue in the film.
That's right. And you and I have discussed this previously and where it might rank in the top monologues of all time in film history. But wherever 1, 2, 3, it's up there in the top five. It is so transfixing. Robert Shaw's performance it just hypnotizes you. His delivery, his face. The way that he is talking about this horror that has happened to him, you know, it's right up there with almost, I mean, I would put it side by side with any other monologue from the history of film in terms of being just a where did that come from characterization point in a monologue.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm hard pressed to think of anything more iconic outside of maybe The Shining's Here's Johnny. When it comes to when he tells the story, what's this, black like a doll's eyes? I mean, to me, that is just.
Oh, yeah, dead eyes.
Dead eyes.
Like a doll's eyes.
Like a doll's eyes. That's what it is. Yeah. I always mess it up. But yeah, no, I just, it's that story. And it's just, you can feel yourself leaning in to hear him when he starts. Because I love the way that sound mix goes when he starts it. Because it is so grumbly. And you can tell it's coming from somewhere like really real and deep inside him that. You kind of lean in to listen and you hear this story, and it's every single time it's captivating. And I like you said, I mean, I'm hard pressed to think of something else as you know, as iconic as that, which
and
iconic
and you're
is
right
just
about,
a word.
Yeah. And you're right about the way that, you know, that he does start off grumbly. Like he doesn't really want to talk about this, but they kind of forced him into it. You know, the everything that happened previously is played for humor. They're showing scars. Everyone's laughing. And then he reaches out and he grabs Hooper's arm. He's like, that, Mr. Hooper, is the USS Indianapolis. And everyone just stops and you stop too as a movie audience and just lean in forward. And I find myself every time I'm watching this leaning in, like he's whispering almost, and then, of course, you know, this movie, you know that it's really embedded itself in the culture because there are so many classic lines from this that are, you know, have become memes, like we're going to need a bigger boat. But I like, you know, and I just want to spotlight some of them, and most of them are from Quint. You know, the his rendition of farewell and adieu to you fair Spanish ladies, you know, that is, and it actually, like, it's incorporated into John Williams' score, like, later on, while they're on the boat, or you know, the his little limerick, here lies the grave of Mary Lee, she died at the age of 103, for 15 years she kept her virginity, not a bad record for this vicinity. And when I was researching this, when that was ad-libbed by Robert Shaw on set, because they said, you know, you just want to be giving Mrs. Brody a hard time, so say things that'll make her upset. And so when he said that during filming, Spielberg came up to him and was like, well, hey, where'd you get that from? Because I'm worried, like, we need to get the rights for that. We don't want to get sued. And he said, oh, I don't think you're going to have to worry about that. I read it off of an actual Irish tombstone. Which is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. All of that interaction, everything that comes out of Robert Shaw's mouth in this movie is, to some degree, you know, quotable. Every yeah, single line. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I could go on for days, Blaine, about how much I love this movie. I could talk about. And actually, I am going to talk about the scene where Mrs. Kittner comes in and slaps Chief Brody on the dock. The next time you watch that, pay attention to the sound design of that movie. She comes in, you hear the milling around in the background, because this is when they just caught the shark, the first shark, the red herring shark. And you hear all the people in the background. It's just a jumble of conversation and noise. And she comes in, and when she slaps him, all of that dies down. And a lesser director would have cut to a reaction shot of the other people in the crowd to show that now they're paying attention. But Spielberg doesn't need to do that. All he does is just eliminate that sound. So now Brody and Mrs. Kittner are covered in silence. You know that everyone, even without seeing it, you know that everyone on that dock is now watching them. They are spotlighted, and they're spotlighted by sound. And that is something that is really, you know, it's so subtle. And you expect a director to have a heavy hand because he doesn't trust his audience. But Spielberg, a lot of times, at least in his early iteration as a director, that was what he was known for. He trusted his audience.
Right. Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's kind of goes the opposite route of like Hitchcock, which always said, you know, you kind of got to play to everyone and always explain. As soon as he does it, it also, I like that they have that scene in there, because not only does it you know, highlight the sound design, but it also gives a face to these victims, to where once, you know, everyone's excited, they think that they've caught it, it's not going to bring anybody back. And even if they win, you know, if and when they kill the shark, these are all people in this small town. Everybody knows everybody. So even when they do kill it, it's not going to do any good to the families, because those are real, you know, real victims, and the families of victims in the movie. So I love that. No, that scene is absolutely fantastic.
And that's a perfect point. Very rarely in these kind of nature run amok or monster movies or serial killer movies does the director, or, you know, the script really pause to dwell on the human cost and the emotional cost, or the cost to the community? And Jaws, because it has already developed this sense of community in the town, and this the idea that these characters are actually living in this space, and to take time out of this propulsive story of you know, the shark attacking, they're going to go kill it, to highlight the human cost and the human trauma that's coming from it, and then to have it play into our major character, the hero, and how it might then affect his decisions going forward. Because, you know, after that we get that great dinner scene where he you know, he's annoyed at his wife. He drinks like an entire glass of wine. That's when Hooper comes over and brings two bottles, and we actually see Roy Scheider's character, Chief Brody, kill both of those bottles over the next 10 minutes. It really is. The human cost is, even while it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be front and center all the time, but to just take time out and to have that play in front of Chief Brody and the audience is, it really makes it like a, it's not just a monster movie. It's not just a titillating story. It's a human drama.
Oh yeah. I mean, and that's made even more clear when you realize that you don't see this damn shark until, you know, 25 minutes after that scene, because at that point we still haven't seen anything more than a fin here and there.
Yeah, that's right. And that was famously caused by the shark malfunctioning over and over again. But what a great
shark,
lesson.
Right?
Yeah, Bruce the Shark. That's right. And but what a great lesson. If you want to heighten tension, if your story is built around a mysterious, unknowable force of nature, it really makes sense to keep it mysterious and unknowable for as long as possible.
Yeah, and then when you do show it big like they do in Jaws. Because when that shark comes up right before the classic line, we're going to need a bigger boat.
That's right.
That is one of the most jarring things. Even after you've seen the movie 50 times, as soon as it pops up, they're not hiding it anymore. They reveal this big, ferocious shark, and I love it.
Yeah, and then just one more thing that I want to highlight about the movie. The final scene is, everything builds up to that final scene, and they set it up throughout the story. It's not like it was just a deus ex machina. Oh, we have a bomb. Like this idea of the tanks being explosive and volatile has been set up through the entire thing. The fact that it involved Roy Scheider getting over his fear of the ocean, as he's going down into the ocean, he has to just swallow all of that. I mean, he's either going to be drowned or eaten in a very short amount of time. And then the smile, you son of a bitch, like that, that is such a classic climax and such a classic ending to a movie. It's near and dear to my heart. I am completely biased. I have so many blinders on when it comes to this movie, but it's just a perfect way to end it.
Absolutely. And everything in that film, I mean, I think we've gone on record and said enough times, this is a nearly perfect movie. You're a super big weirdo if you don't love it. If you don't love it, yeah. I do want you to reach out because I'm really curious as to why. But I think we've talked about this movie as we can. So let's transition and take a look at our top five lists of Nature Run Amok films, Jaws with Paws. All right, we're back. You're getting ready to talk about our top five Nature Run Amok films. I'm going to kick us off with my number five since Chris led us into here. I'm going to start off with a much, much, much worse movie than Jaws. It's 1978's The Bees, directed by Alfredo Zacharias. It is a ridiculous kind of throwback to 1950s sci-fi. It's about a evil corporation that the U.S. government is bringing in these South American killer bees who end up mutating naturally with evolution into intelligent insects and end up attacking helpless people left and right. And a young scientist ends up working desperately to try to end this this threat as it swarms all of the city areas. As sci-fi as it sounds, there's not a whole lot of actual exposition in this movie. It's like killer bees show up, they go through, and they literally pick their victims clean. What I actually love about this movie is, as silly as it is, it has some of the best performances you get out of it, out of a late John Carradine. When he's kind of past his prime, he's doing a lot of these kind of shittier, you know, second run kind of films, things like The Corpse Grinders. He really gets this kind of meaty role as the older scientist, and he plays really great against, you know, cult legend John Saxon, as well as the very, very foxy star of The Teacher, Miss Angel Tompkins. And it's not a great movie, but it's a lot of fun. I had caught it throughout my youth. It used to come on AMC a lot of times early in the morning. But it recently got a great Blu-ray release through Vinegar Syndrome, where they did a real nice 4K transfer. And I really think seeing that movie cleaned up gives it a lot more validity. And it does play out as something kind of special. It's not perfect. It's got a lot of silliness. It really seems like it was made in the wrong era, because it definitely feels more at home with something in the late 50s and early 60s. But overall, it is a lot of fun and something that I think is worth watching.
And yet again, another movie that I have not seen. When I think of Killer Bees, this probably says something about me. I think of Leonard Six.
Right.
where Bill Cosby calls down killer bees to take out the bad guys. But I, you know, the idea of killer bees swarming and picking bones, picking the flesh off of their victims is, I mean, it sounds great.
Oh, it is. And most of the bees, they're mainly represented just by sound. And then you'll see just a giant swarm of bees, which they will quickly and violently destroy. And eventually, because I don't feel bad ruining this movie, in the end, the bees have learned how to communicate and are speaking to us about us ending
communicate with us.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's kind of funny to see a dated version of discussions about global warming and everything. And yeah, they basically are trying to call a truce with human beings because of how poorly we've treated the ecosystem. But it gets real silly, real corny, but my God, I love John Carradine.
That sounds like the Japanese strategy in World War II. We're going to come in hard and fast, and then we're going to sue for peace.
Exactly. Well, Axel, what was your number five on this list?
My number five was Lake Placid, which is a movie that was, you know, it's not necessarily well received. It's got, you know, but not, I, you know, one of the things that I realized in putting together this list is how few nature run amok movies there are. You know, we tried to limit them to actual things that could happen in nature as opposed to genetically modified beasts like Deep Blue Sea or, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I saw Lake Placid in Maine with my cousins who live in Maine. And, it struck me when I was watching it as a probably more of a personal a film experience than what maybe it struck everyone else. But, I really enjoy, first of all, you have the whole cliche of like getting, you know, it's like getting the gang, like a whole like group of people together. Each of them have their own specialties. So you have the, you know, the scientist and the chief of police and the, and this eccentric, mythologist, Oliver Platt, which is really strange that he would just show up and he's really basically there for a comic relief. But it's not perfect, but it really is enjoyable. Have you seen this movie?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I saw it in theaters as well. I remember really liking it a lot at that point. And then I remember I was just old enough to really kind of give a shit about critical response and kind of wondered why people were kind of trashing it. But I revisited this probably about 9 or 10 months ago, and I still think it plays really well. It's a fun kind of horror comedy, I guess. But yeah, no, it plays out really well. David E. Kelly was at top of his game at that time, really writes out some fun characters. And yeah, it's like you said, it's one of those movies, you know, you're putting together this crack team of, you know, scientists and adventurers and all these sort of things to go after this giant monster. And I think with that kind of movie, that's as much as you can ask for, and you can walk away pretty happy.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, this movie involves it's set in Maine at a fictional location, Black Lake, and it involves a giant 30-foot saltwater crocodile who has set up shop in this lake and is we open with the the crocodile eating one of the local wildlife, which happens to be a sheriff, and then of course the investigation ensues. We have some parties with different interests, and there's conflict amongst the group. And this is definitely one of those movies that I was talking about, where everyone comes fully realized. The action in the movie doesn't really draw out anything of their character. It just solidifies their character. And there's no surprises, really. It kind of goes through the classic beats of a horror movie. But it comes across as very enjoyable and unique.
Oh, absolutely. And unique is the word I will use for my next pick, number four, which is Squirm from 1976. It is a strange little oddity that was filmed here. We're located out in Atlanta, Georgia. So it was shot kind of in this area, down more towards Savannah. But it follows a small Georgia town that ends up getting taken over by flesh-burrowing worms who are actually kind of brought about by a wild electricity storm that comes through that ends up activating these. And it's one of those movies that would always play on TBS here, especially when it was a local channel. And, you know, after you'd watch a Braves game, about over 50% of the time, the next thing that they would just fill time with was Squirm. And there's not a whole lot of anything as far as like characters and acting, things like that. It feels very amateurish at a lot of points. But what's great is seeing these early special effects by Rick Baker, and they are gnarly when they happen. And the way that they end up putting everything together, it's a lot of fun. You get a lot of these kind of classic, like, simple redneck characters. You get a city boy who comes through and he's got to learn, you know, how to kind of make it through this small town without offending every person he meets and not getting his ass kicked at every corner. But it's one of those movies that I probably like it more because of the nostalgia. But upon rewatching it this week, I still had a really fun time kind of just waiting for those moments where it came up. And it's a lot of fun seeing, Georgia during this era, especially in kind of a backwater town. And at that point, they weren't making a whole lot of stuff here. You had movies like Poor Pretty Eddie and Squirm that were being shot here, but not a whole lot more. But it's amazing to see, kind of the jump that Rick Baker made from, doing a movie like Squirm, that only 3 years later he's putting together the greatest transformation scene in history with An American Werewolf in London. So I think that movie kind of stands alone with that. Did you end up ever staying up too late after a Braves game and catching this movie?
No, actually, the Braves game always put me to sleep. So by the time it's into the fourth inning, I'm out. when I even endeavor to watch. Yet another one that I it's got to be on my list. I got to see this because, there's so few of these nature run amok movies that it really is worthwhile to see all of them. And my next movie, again, something that I saw, when it came out in 1997, and it kind of stuck with me, and I haven't had a lot of opportunities to revisit, but I do, I did get to see it recently. And, while it has some flaws, it's really enjoyable. And this is Anaconda with Jennifer Lopez and Ice Cube, John Voight as playing one of my favorite, hammiest John Voight characters in his entire oeuvre. or however you say that word. And then, of course, we have Owen Wilson making an appearance in one of his B-side movies. And this movie is – it's basically a fish out of water where these documentary filmmakers go into the Amazon jungle and they're going to make a documentary film. They get faced with this – the mother of all anacondas. They get involved with this snake hunter, John Voight, and they – And of course, it becomes a classic like monster movie or horror movie where the snake is trying to kill them all. And I don't know if you've seen this movie, but it really is one of those where if you have a Saturday afternoon where nothing's going on and you don't really feel like being moved or intellectually challenged by it, you just want to sit and watch an enjoyable, entertaining movie, this is your movie. There are parts of it that are ridiculous. There are parts of it that are scary. There are parts of it that are just eye rolling, but overall it's an enjoyable experience.
Oh yeah. And I'm in the same boat. I saw it when it came out. I haven't really revisited it too much over the years, but what I always remember was seeing on the poster, it said, "When you can't scream, when you can't breathe, you can't scream." And I always thought, "Yeah, no shit." And but I always thought that was a great piece of marketing. But yeah
it's a life lesson.
Absolutely, yeah. Just in case you're ever wondering, if you can't breathe, you can't scream. But yeah, it's one of those movies that I need to kind of make my way back around to. And I know I've caught like pieces here and there back when I in the days where I had cable. But yeah, I want to make it back and kind of see this kind of, late 90s silliness. So,
it's definitely a highlight for Jennifer Lopez in the sense that she's in a very like provocative tank top with no bra, battling snakes, and it's a Jennifer Lopez movie that you would appreciate if you were a man.
No, absolutely, and she looks fantastic in it. She definitely plays up that side, because that was kind of during that era where they were really trying to get her to be a movie star, and because you had her in Monster in Law, Jersey Girl,
Out of Sight,
Angel Eyes, The Cell. They were really trying to get her.
The Cell. That's a great callback. I haven't seen The Cell probably since it came out.
Yeah, those special effects did not age well. But she looks fantastic in it. And I always remember the very classic panties scene in that where she's smoking a joint and goes and leans into the refrigerator, and yeah, that's the only thing really worth revisiting on that.
That's a lot of Jennifer Lopez movies actually for me.
Yeah. No, she definitely was in her prime during this era. But my next movie that I wanted to maybe a little bit of a step up here. I think we're working our way into some better movies on this list. But it is the incredibly classic 1963 film by none other than Alfred Hitchcock, The Birds, which is one of my favorite movies. If I had to do like a top 25 or top 50, this would probably make its way into it. It's nice because it predates, it predates Jaws and what they're doing with this other very unexplained phenomena where you have, Rod Taylor and Tippi Hedren making their way across, the countryside, facing off against what's literally birds. And it plays a lot of kind of the Freudian sides of Hitchcock movies, and was one of these films that when I was younger, I remember every time I was sick, I would always end up popping in this VHS recording that I had taken off of AMC and watching it over and over again, because I don't know, it just plays out as such such a transition film between this like classic Universal movie into something that is just feels incredibly modern. And I mean, as most of Hitchcock movies do, but yeah, this is one that I think is great. It's incredibly violent for the era. You know, Tippi Hedren is amazing. I can't say enough good stuff about this movie. I know this is one that you have seen, and I'm curious to kind of get your opinion here.
Yeah, that's right. And so I recently went back and watched the trailer, and the trailer is so cloying and and retrograde. And I was trying to get Robin to watch it, and it completely removes you from what the story actually is, was just this slow burn of horror based on, you know, with these birds like showing up. The movie really is it's a masterpiece. There's really nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It's something that you can rewatch with your children, and with you can rewatch just on a Saturday afternoon where, you know, maybe it's like it's raining outside and you want to kind of like delve back into like classic cinema. But it's classic Hitchcock. It's one of the best Hitchcock movies that I think that I've seen. You know, I would rate it right up there with Vertigo.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's definitely that top tier where you have, you know, the Vertigos, the North by Northwest, Psycho, and the Birds, and I don't know. I just love it. And also, I remember when I was a kid seeing it and realizing there was something weird going on with these Hitchcock movies, because you kind of get that weird psychosexual side with, you know, his mother played by Jessica Tandy and his younger sister Kathy, and you know, he's trying to, you know, balance this, plus he's got, you know, his you know, the girlfriend and everything like that. And I just love the way Hitchcock unveils his version of suspense and horror. And I don't want to talk too much, because I'm hoping that soon we'll make our way to a Hitchcock movie, because I am looking for any excuse to just watch through Hitchcock movies all the time instead of my normal garbage I dig up off YouTube here. So yeah, so what was your next film that you had?
Well, my third movie for Nature Run Amok was The Ghost in the Darkness. Oof. And this is for those who don't know, this is about an engineer played by Val Kilmer who goes to Africa to build a bridge across this river in Tsavo. And it's basically Tsavo is set up as being like a kind of a heart of darkness destination, and where the, you know, and the racial politics in this movie are very, well, I was going to say they're interesting, where you have all of these workers trying to build a railroad for the English Empire, and then Val Kilmer comes in to build a bridge across a river to continue the railroad so they can beat the French and the other English powers that are trying to colonize this space. And Val Kilmer gets to this location, and they're being terrorized by these two lions. Now, they're not necessarily being terrorized by the two lions when he shows up. It's only after he kills a lion that the two, you know, and they're called the Ghosts in the Darkness by the locals. So that refers to the two male lions that have formed a gang, and they're going to terrorize this village of workers and obviously people that have developed malaria and that are in the hospital and everything. But it's that movie completely changes when Michael Douglas's character Remington shows up, and then it becomes just a blast. Michael Douglas is chewing scenery in every single line that he has. And I actually, in researching this, I realized that Michael Douglas and the director had a lot of butting of the heads, because Michael Douglas was the producer and also decided to cast himself in the Remington character and then cut the movie to make sure that the Remington character had way more scenes than what was in the script. But I'm fine with it. That Michael Douglas, all of his little one-liners and his wisdoms that he imparts upon Val Kilmer and the locals, the movie, and I just watched this last week, the movie really does kind of stand up. It is a tense movie about these two lions that have taken umbrage against this village, and they're going to treat the village like they're like a buffet. They're going to come in, they're going to kill everybody whenever they want. They seem to be unkillable. There's a lot of scenes where they try to trap the lions, or they set up different scenarios where the lions couldn't possibly escape, but they do, and they take their dead off, and they seem to know who's in charge, so they go after them. It's a really great movie.
Yeah, this is a movie that I got a chance to watch a few minutes of it recently, and I enjoyed watching, you know, Val Kilmer and Michael Douglas, you know, like as you stated, chew scenery pretty much. I do want to finish this one up when I get a chance, but it was one of those things. I forgot that this was directed by Stephen Hopkins, who's one of those guys who's had such a bizarre Hollywood career, because I don't know how the guy kept getting work, because in a row he directed Dangerous Game, which is fantastic, with Gary Busey and Ice-T. I think, isn't it? I believe that, if I'm not confused.
Oh, no, you're talking about...
That's Surviving the Game. I'm screwing this up, but he did Dangerous Game. Then he did Nightmare on Elm Street 5, which I don't know if anyone enjoys that that iteration. Predator 2, which I love, but is not
love
a good
Predator
movie.
2. Love that movie.
I love it, but I mean, when we watch it, we know it's not great. Then he did Judgment Night, Blown Away, and then still kept working with high-profile films like Ghost in the Darkness and Lost in Space. But it's such an interesting, because he really kind of ran the gambit of these kind of forgettable films that are probably way better than history treats them. But I just thought that was so interesting, kind of going through what he had made. But
and one of the things I really enjoy about this, so you're talking about Blown Away, not the there's one Blown Away that has the Corey brothers in it, the Corey Feldman, Corey Haim, and there's one Blown Away that has
Jeff Bridges
and Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yep, that's the one I'm talking about. But yeah, Stephen Hopkins is a really interesting career, but I'm I really do need to finish up watching Ghost in the Darkness, because it from what I was watching it just reminded me of a lot of also how great Val Kilmer was in this era. I mean, now I know he's kind of gotten to be kind of a bloated weirdo. But in this era, he just plays it so well and so cool.
That's right. I think he got his diet in terms of the bloating from being on the island of Dr. Moreau. Yeah.
He always just looks like he's holding like a lot of fluids.
He really does. He looks puffy.
He does. He looks very puffy.
That's right. Yeah, this is like one of his more svelte roles. And he does come across as like a movie star. He's really good in this movie.
Yeah, because that's one thing I think a lot of people forget is, man, he, at this point in the mid and late 90s, he is a full-blown movie star. He comes out with a movie, we're all going to see it. And it's just so funny how his own kind of personal choices led him to be still as talented as ever. Because don't get me wrong, just maybe not with the selections that he used to have.
That's really funny. He definitely took some side roads.
Oh, absolutely, he really did. But moving on to my number two film, it is a movie that is one of the quickest Jaws ripoffs that came out, and that was 1977's film Orca the Killer Whale, directed by Michael Anderson. Came from Dino De Laurentiis and his production company, who literally said, let's make a Jaws movie. And this film, it is incredibly similar. It plays out with a lot of the same kind of characters coming through, where, you know, you're hiring a guy who mainly kills sharks, but he's gonna kill this whale. But what is amazing about this movie is it kind of deceives you, and there is an incredibly like good human story throughout. And it really, you know, it's got, to mention another Carradine, it's got Robert Carradine, who's a local scientist who's you know, being targeted by the shark. The orca comes along, it kills the shark, and then switches the target. Then they automatically, the team ends up turning on the giant killer whale, and ends up creating this entire kind of revenge film where one orca is avenging the death of its mate and going after these characters. Also, you've got Charlotte Rampling, who's great. Bo Derek, who looks fantastic. I wish I could say more about her performance, but that's she's there to look great. It's a great ripoff. It really tries its best to be on par with Jaws. And what's amazing is they brought in a lot of artificial whales, and the story goes that they look so realistic that they actually had animal rights groups protesting it when they were moving them in these controlled areas.
Oh wow! So, for like the ostensible mistreatment of animals.
Exactly. So when you watch this movie, it's got fantastic special effects, and I'm not comparing it with the score from Jaws, but Ennio Morricone scored the film. And it's a very, very different kind of score, and it creates just a very different kind of movie that's clearly ripping off a better, you know, A-plus movie. But this kind of combination of you know, having Robert Carradine, this grand Italian score, and a great special effects, it's a lot of fun. And when you watch some of the later Jaws movies where they do kind of focus on this revenge angle, I like to imagine a world where, as much as Orca ripped off Jaws, those Jaws sequels kind of ripped off Orca. So that's kind of the fantasy I like to live in.
Well, that's right. My fantasy is imagining that there's a reason that they produced the sequels to Jaws. So that makes sense. I'm glad, you know, hopefully they did actually see something that was inspirational and decided that, okay, hey, we could do that. So my next movie is Arachnophobia. I think this movie is a classic. So first of all, just to give the listeners a little bit of background, it's a 1990 movie. It's directed by Frank Marshall. It stars Jeff Daniels at the height of his powers, as insofar as he had any height of his powers, and John Goodman. And John Goodman is great in this movie. But this movie involves spiders. As the title probably told you, and it involves this poisonous, extremely poisonous, deadly spider that comes from South America. It kills a scientist. It takes a ride on his coffin back to the United States, and then he sets up shop in this small town and starts mating with the local wildlife, the smaller female spiders, and develops this army of deadly spiders that when they bite you, you are dead. So the movie is, it kind of tracks this small town coming to realization about the fact they have a deadly spider epidemic. And there are certain scenes in this movie that just stand out, like the shower scene where the spiders come out of the drain, out of the sink. And, you know, it really is. You go back and watch it, And I urge everyone listening to this to go back and watch it. It is a really good movie that holds up.
Oh, yeah. This is one that I got to revisit this week, and I forgot. I am allergic to spiders, so the whole time I'm watching the movie, I am, like, scratching my arms. Like, I keep feeling things climb on me. It is so effective. But on the other side, it's so fun. It's a lot of, like... It's a lot of, you know, great comedy mixed in there. And like you said, John Goodman, I think this is one of those movies that kind of like set the tone of John Goodman's, you know, kind of typical performance and what we kind of came to expect from him. And, oh, he is just on point. And I know you and I talked about this a little off air, but both Arachnophobia and The Burbs are two movies that I always forget how great they are and how well they hold up. And I have to revisit them every few years because they're Arachnophobia. I mean, it's, I would argue that it's a classic, you know, comedy kind of from that same era we talked about before. And I was so happy that you had this on your list that gave me a chance to rewatch it. Cause holy shit, it is effective.
Yeah. I got to rewatch it just a couple weeks ago. Everything that I remember about it in terms of like its punch, its humor, all of that, it's still there. There's no diminishing of it because it was made in the 90s. It is a really well done movie. And the whole setting, the build, the climax with, you know, you have the female spider that gets got in the barn, and then you have the general that gets got in the wine cellar. It really is. It's fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. Moving into another movie, my number one, which is, I know it's not the best, but I love it. It's 1976 Grizzly. This movie is more important to me mainly because this is one of the earliest memories that I have of loving B cinema. I caught it early on a free weekend of the movie channel, if anyone remembers those during the early days of cable. And it was just this awesomely gory ripoff of Jaws, where one of my favorite actors of all time, Christopher George, who's known for being in a lot of these Italian and Spanish co-productions, like the Lucio Fulci films, as well as the absolutely mind-boggling pieces. It's a very simple story, directly ripping off Jaws. It's about an 18-foot tall grizzly bear who's terrorizing a state park, leaving it up to a park ranger and a weird survivalist to kill it. And that's what it is. What it does that's so much fun is it takes almost beat for beat the Jaws, the Jaws story, but just makes it way dumber and way more violent. This giant bear is coming through, and when he like ravages people, it's knocking off heads, it's tearing off arms, and then shockingly just leaving areas really clean. It really takes that entire idea of a natural force like a serial killer to a whole other degree. But it's just a fun movie. It's one of those ones that I end up on a bored day. You know, it's rainy outside on a Saturday afternoon. I can throw that in and just do things around the house and just love it and kind of tune in for those great moments. But whenever Andrew Prine and Christopher George are on screen, it really is great. And I think, you know, they don't have the writing that you see in a movie like Jaws, but you get that same sort of back and forth and that same kind of interplay with all the characters. And you feel like you're following someone at their job who is not prepared for the situation, but still sticks to it. Doesn't evolve into some sort of crazy, you know, crazy maniac out for revenge. He's a guy doing his job. And you'll forget when I revisited the film, how amazing. It's got these great nature scenes where a lot of scenes from you know, helicopters flying throughout these national forests. It's got this sweeping, bizarre, old-fashioned score where it's very, you know, very heavily symphony style score that makes everything feel really grand and sweeping, even though it's this really 25-cent version of Jaws. If you haven't seen it, it's available on Amazon Prime. Anyone who enjoys Jaws will at least enjoy how shameless it is. And when we talk about Jaws with Paws, this is the movie that ended up taking that title. So, yeah, it may not be better than a lot of the movies that are on both of our lists, but it's still my number one. And I know this is one that we've talked about a little bit, and I don't believe you've got a chance to check it out, if I'm correct.
No, that's right. I haven't been able – I have never seen this movie, but I think it's a really good lesson, and maybe any budding filmmakers that are out there listening, it's never a mistake to go dumber and more violent.
Hey, you'll get my money every time.
Yeah, just do it. You know, there's so much space. I mean, if there's anything that I've learned in putting together this list is how much space there is out there for nature run amok. There are very few movies that capture that. And if you want to go dumber and more violent, if you want to go more highbrow and character centric, there is so much out there that has not been done yet in this genre.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and there's endless, because once you start kind of falling down this late 70s, early 80s B movie thing, there are a lot that end up popping up. There's a lot of forgettable ones, movies like, which is shockingly is directed by the same person as Grizzly, William Girdler, but Day of the Animals is another one that is a lot of fun, uses a whole bunch of stock footage and tries to make you think that these animals are coming for these main characters. But a great one that I wanted to mention but couldn't really find a spot and not sure how it really falls into it is the film Wild Beast, which is an Italian film where someone decides to put PCP in the water supply of a zoo. So yeah, like you said, there is a lot of space for everybody.
What a plan. It's like put PCP into the water supply of the zoo, ...
Right.
Profit.
Hey, that's
Chris, great.
I don't know if everyone has already guessed this. What's your number one?
It's Jaws. I love that movie. It's my number one overall. It's my number one Jaws and Paws. It's my number one any kind of movie you want to throw at me. Jaws is my thing.
No, and I think we talked about it enough between our first two episodes. But yeah, you're not going to find better in the genre. It's the best. It's king shit of these kind of summer blockbusters. So with that said, we're going to take a quick break and then move into our plugs and goodbyes.
All right.
Be a DJ dancing.
Nice. He's doing DJ dancing.
Doing the Mortal Kombat song.
Mortal Kombat.
Oh, man. We got to do an episode on Mortal Kombat today. All right.
And with the song in the background.
The entire time.
Yeah, for sure.
Fatality.
Yeah, so next week we have, seriously, one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite subjects, RoboCop. And because it came out in 1987, we are doing, and that was 30 years ago, we are doing a whole podcast on movies from 1987, which just happens to be movies that have had a tremendous impact on our lives.
When I noticed that film was turning 30, there's so much to pull from there, because those are really the movies that we first started seeing during the VHS boom. So I'm excited to see what you got on that list. And I think a lot of people will be able to guess what's on mine.
Yeah, well, 1987 is so fertile. I really hope that maybe I can come up with something unique and unexpected, but I bet everyone can guess what's on mine.
Everyone
too.
In our age range is probably going to be somewhere along our two groups of picks.
I think so. All right, Blaine. Well, this has been a lot of fun, man.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so happy that we're able to get back together. Thank you so much for everybody with you know, your praises and your criticisms of our episode number one. Please feel free to reach out to us on any of the social medias. You can find me at @Mondo_McLaren at both Twitter and Instagram. And we'll look forward to seeing you guys out here next week.
All right. Well, you guys, you know, keep the criticism coming. You know, we're just starting out. We really want to make sure that you guys have a good time. Let us know what you think.
Absolutely. Well, with that said, everybody out there, have a great day, and we'll see you soon. Peace.
Music.
Mortal Kombat.
Mortal Kombat. That's all. Fatality.